Welcome to Uncorked, another podcast brought to you by Team Corker. This week, we have a local Pacific Northwest legend by the name of Dr. Russell Kennedy. He is the author of Anxiety RX. He has been a doctor, actually a stand-up comedian. He's a husband, he's a father, he is a grandfather. He is many, many interesting titles, but I'm a little bit tongue smacked and gabbled because Dr. Russell was on the Mel Robbins podcast to talk to you about anxiety. Dr. Russell was also on our friends, A Little More Good, the producers of this podcast, their show. And then he said yes, and he jumped on our show. And so while I want to just pause and celebrate how cool it is to have this incredible legend. His second book will be launched in September globally with a European print and an American imprint. And it's just not lost on me the power of connection and the power of being in all of these different spheres and conversations together. And with the same joy brings me the same truth that anxiety does not discriminate. It does not know geographical bounds. And anxiety is something that many of us have had varying experiences that haven't been so fun with. So for the work of Dr. Russ, I am so grateful that he has studied and really shared his own life story enough to help the underbelly of the joy that is connection, which is mental health and mental struggles. So all of that to be said, check him out on Mel Robbins. Check him out with A Little More Good. I think he said he has been on 200 plus podcasts. He needs no introduction. Check out his book, check out his new book, and enjoy this conversation. It made me smile, and I hope it makes you smile too. Well, just like that, we have Dr. Russ on the mic, on the pod today. And I will tell you, I have been holding out for this conversation, and one that I am very grateful made the calendar. So thank you for your time, and thank you for saying yes.
Well, it's great to be here, Steph. Let's do this.
Let's do this. Well, I want to dive in by asking you to introduce yourself to our listeners of who are you, Dr. Russ, in 2024, in this moment in time. What do we need to know about you?
Okay, so I'm a doctor and a clinical neuroscientist. I left medicine about 10 years ago because I found that we were dealing too much with treating symptoms rather than treating the root cause. My father was schizophrenic and bipolar, so I grew up with a lot of chaos and trauma, which allowed me to develop an anxiety disorder myself. And I had to find ways of treating it because every way that I learned to treat through traditional methods and psychotherapy didn't work. How's that?
Mic drop. I mean, that's a
big
piece. I
know you only have 25 minutes, so it's like okay.
Who you are.
We're gonna get a lot of stuff in here.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to riff off of that. I also want to, I can't help but ask, like, what's life been like this for you?
Well, for a long time, it was brutal. Like I just wrote last night, I was just writing a little bit of stuff for the new book. Just about for 35 years, I woke up every day in alarm. And I prefer the term alarm as opposed to anxiety. Anxiety to me has very little consciousness to it. Words definitely have consciousness to them. So everybody's been alarmed. Everyone knows what alarm feels like. But not everybody knows what anxiety feels like. So even though they may, I have people that say, I didn't even know I had anxiety until I read your book. So it's like, well, I don't know if I'm doing you any favors, but it is like, I prefer the term alarm to anxiety because that is really what it is. It's a state of alarm held in your body, typically from old unresolved wounds that radiates through your mind. So a lot of traditional therapy believes that we got to fix the mind, but what if the mind is just the byproduct? What if your mind is just reacting to this old trauma that's stored in your body? And if we change your mind, we're not really doing anything for the old trauma that's held in your body, which is the real underlying root cause of what we call quote unquote anxiety.
Got it. Okay. So for 35 years, it was brutal and you woke up with alarm. I can't help but ask, what is your relationship with your body now?
Well, I became a yoga teacher in 2007. So that's really been helpful. And I guess it's just, and doing somatic therapy, I'm also trained in something called somatic experiencing. So I did Peter Levine's 3-year training in that, which really kind of expanded my sense of my own body. There's also a great book that I always recommend to people. It's called Body Aware by Erica Hornthal. And it really gets you into your body because so much of our life is through our body. We feel our emotions through our body. And one of the things that I say in the book is that if you were just a brain, you know, being fed with blood and bathed in cerebrospinal fluid, would you feel anything? And I think it's your body that allows you to feel, but it's also the place that holds a lot of that old unresolved stuff that just typically comes from childhood, not always, but typically. And that's the stuff that we need to get at. That's what we have to unearth. That's what we have to clear out in order to clear the mind, so the mind isn't constantly in survival mode.
Yeah. So you're a yoga teacher, and there is something, you know, that you have a practice within your body. And of course, I love that not only are you within your body, but then you become a teacher for others to come and practice with you. But did you notice any shifts in your own body when you started to uncover that life wasn't going to be about alarm anymore?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that allowed me to see that the body held a lot of my alarm was a trip on LSD, which I did in 2013 with a friend of mine who's very versed in Ayurvedic medicine. And what I learned on that trip was that my anxiety was actually the state of alarm that was held in my solar plexus. And it's hot. It's like the shape of a fist. It presses up into my heart. It's purple, it's crystalline, it's sharp. There's a lot of things that I've kind of delved into. And realizing that was the locus of my anxiety allowed me to focus on that area. And I also believe that that alarm is a version of my younger self. If you know, like internal family systems therapy and that kind of thing, there is a version of myself that's trapped in that alarm. And sometimes as a medical doctor and clinical neuroscientist, I want to have a seizure when I start talking about this because it sounds so woo. But I also remind people that I did every type of therapy that traditional medicine had to offer, and it didn't really help. I mean, it helps in the short term, like CBT and those sort of things help you in the short term. But what you have to remember is when you go into survival mode, when you go into alarm, your rational mind gets shut off in favor of your emotional brain, your survival brain. And we can't rationally think our way out of a feeling problem. And I think that's what we try and train people to do. And in universities and therapy, people that get trained to be therapists, they're trained in this very cognitive mode. And I like to remind people that the amygdala, the pons, the medulla, the brainstem, the parts of your brain that actually hold or manifest some of this trauma through your body, none of those structures understand language. They understand feeling. So we're trying to change a feeling with a thinking, and it doesn't work. It works in the short term. I have to create, and I have nothing against CBT. It's just that it's going to help you cope. It's not going to help you heal. Same with science. I mean, I love Huberman. I love the stuff that he talks about, but science will help you cope with things. But to heal, you have to go back and find that younger version of you that was abandoned, lost, rejected, bullied, whatever, and really connect with them. Not that you have to connect with the story so much, but you have to connect with the feeling, because it's the feeling that holds the linchpin of the thinking. So if we could heal the feeling, the thinking doesn't get so harried and scary anymore.
Oh my gosh, the feeling. I've been diving into the work of Dr. Julie Caldwell and the Hendricks, and I just love that it's so heart-centered. They're all about the feeling. It's like our brain just works on overdrive and our body is here in feeling land. So yes, yes, yes. I mean, I mentioned the Hendricks, and I'm diving into one of Gay's books right now, The Big Leap Year,
right,
calling it like the Bible of 2024. It would be remiss if we don't talk about your book, your first book, knowing that your second book is coming. I always love to ask the author, though, what was the impetus? What was the heartbeat that said, I need to publish a book?
I think it was my frustration with traditional therapy and how nothing really helped me. And then when I found something that really did help me, to be able to mesh that with what I knew as a medical doctor and a neuroscientist and be able to explain that to people in ways that they understand. Because there's a lot of people out there that are very kind of woo, oh, we have to feel it, we have to pray, and there's nothing wrong with that. And there's also another wing of people who are highly scientific. It's like, okay, we have to take these medications. Anxiety is a biochemical imbalance. And it's like, I blend these things together. So I put them together in a way that people can understand. So if you want to talk about the bed nucleus of the striatum terminalis and the basal ganglia in informing worries, I can talk about that. But if you also want to talk about putting your hand over your alarm and just breathing into it and seeing a younger version of you that you that needs to be seen, heard, understood, loved, and protected, I can talk about that too.
Mm-hmm. And that caused a book to be born called Anxiety Rx. Which we will ensure is linked in the show notes. And you shared that you self-published this and it went wackadoodle across the globe. Can't help but ask, did you have a vision or a goal in publishing a book of what you thought might happen?
I didn't really. I just knew that I had to get this out because so much of traditional therapy, like I said, didn't help me. And people are still pushing traditional therapy really hard. Because if you look at traditional therapy, it's usually people who are trained in universities. And to be trained in university, you need something that's replicatable and something that they can say, okay, I went in on this day, I filled out the anxiety questionnaire, I scored 80. And then 6 months later after the treatment program, I scored 40, which is great, but we're not really dealing with the root cause. So I found the root cause of my anxiety through psychedelics. Not that I'm a big proponent of psychedelics either. It was the scariest thing I've ever done by far. But it gave me an opportunity to see what anxiety really was and how to understand it better and how to treat it better. So that's what I put out the book is it's very different than any other book that's been put out on anxiety. It's the highest rated anxiety book on Amazon. And I think people really resonate with it, with this concept of alarm that's held in their body. And I get messages from people every single day that say, I've been in therapy for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and this is the first thing that's really made sense to me. And that's the reason I put it out was I wanted to help other people. And it really comes back to my dad, Steph. You know, like there was so much pain in my family growing up because of my dad's schizophrenia and his bipolar and his psychosis. That I wanted that pain to mean something. And I, you know, I take real pride in the fact that 80,000 copies of the first book have been sold as a self-publish, you know, which is kind of unheard of. Most self-published books sell less than 200 copies. So when I was approached by the UK and the US to create the second book, it was like, okay, now I have a chance to go in and refine everything that I put into the first book. And it's probably half of it's different. So it gave me a chance to really refine because I've been on like almost 200 podcasts in the last 2.5 years. So I've had a chance to really refine my message. And that's what the second book is all about. The first book is great. It's a lot of personal stories. And my editor said, can we cut out some of the memoir aspect and make it more practical for everyday people? And I didn't know in my first book, like what the hell do I know? I'm not an author. I am now, but that's what I did with the second book. I made it more practical and more relatable to other people as opposed to just relating everything back to myself, which is all I knew in the first book.
So powerful. Well, I want to see if in the last few minutes I can sneak in a couple of questions that you might not have been asked on the other 200 plus podcasts. And it's not out of, you know, I want some dirt or I want to uncover something that hasn't been uncovered as much as, you know, what if we can surprise a listener and throw a question out that hasn't been recorded yet, hasn't been on record yet. And okay. I want to know, because you alluded to it before we hit record, what it was like to be within family on a vacation in sunny Mexico and to come home and have feelings on the other side. And I want to know about the feelings of coming home from sunny Mexico, because I want to project feelings on you, Dr. Russ, that say, wasn't that so wonderful and so relaxing and so magical and magnificent? And you might actually say, no, Steph, that wasn't my experience. Or maybe it was.
I think it was at points, Steph. I think it was really connected and really close. I mean, basically, my father, like I said, was never really able to provide for our family that well because he was always so mentally ill. So with the proceeds from the book, I was able to tell of us from where we live in Victoria. And the other four were my wife's brother, my sister-in-law and their two kids. So there were 16 of us there all together. But for me, I was able to take my 12, myself, my wife, my two stepsons, my daughter, her husband, my two grandkids, Abiel, who's 6 and Angus, who's 4, my brother, his wife, Tammy, and their two kids, Ryan and Avery, and Ryan's a golfer, so Ryan and I played golf quite a bit when we were there. But it was this feeling of just being really enmeshed with family, which I never had when I was younger. So at points it was exhilarating, at other points it was terrifying, because what I point out in the book is that a lot of anxiety results from rejecting love, and specifically rejecting it from yourself. So if you grow up without connection, and you have a sort of a textbook idea of what connection's supposed to be like, you can kind of create that. I mean, I've been married 3 times. So it's one of those things where my early relationships, I really didn't know how to connect. And to some extent, I'm still learning how to do that. And I think that's been the biggest factor in healing from anxiety, is learning how to accept connection from other people and from myself. Now, my family would tell you that I'm very connected. I'm warm and generous. I'm connected. And that kind of thing. And I am, I think, to a certain point. But I think there's a part of me also that's afraid of connection, because of the connection with my father was so tenuous. Like, I loved him a great deal. And a lot of the time he was great, but sometimes he was crazy. So what I learned growing up was, you can't trust this guy because he's either going to go psychotic or depressed. He was never, you know, violent or abusive, but I would lose him to mental illness. So my own little mind said, on some level, love isn't trustable. Love is only going to hurt you, because you're going to love this person and then they're going to disappear in some way, or they're going to become very, very sick or ill or whatever, or depressed. And that was the template that I grew up with. So getting into this position where I'm really connected again is wonderful, but it also brings up all those ego-based alarm bells that love isn't safe. So there's your answer. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so powerful. I love that we can riff with a doctor and an author and all of the other labels that you have, and bring it down to the root of love and our ability to love each other, love ourselves. It makes my heart skip a beat. I really appreciate that. Thank you for sharing. I'm hitting the pause button on this sweet episode to tell you about something that you might like. Our newsletter. We call it the Corkboard. It has all things juicy, whether you are looking to keep in touch between episodes or find out more about our coaching, development, or hot new jobs that we're working on. The link is in our show notes. Your inbox is sacred and your time is too. So now let's get back to the episode. I have to ask, if I may, is your father still with us?
No. I wrote in my book, he committed suicide in 1987. Which is the same year I got into med school. And, you know, one of the biggest regrets of my life is that I couldn't show him the letter of acceptance to medical school, because I got that in June of 1987 and he died in January of 1987.
Okay.
My mom's still going. But she's like Boris the Blade from Snatch. She broke both hips. You know, she's in the hospital now with a pelvic rami fracture. She's 90, almost 91, Scottish, you know, indestructible kind of thing. But she's failing. She's been failing in the last couple of years or so. So, you know, she may not be with us for a whole lot longer either. So my mother was very dutiful, and like a lot of Scottish British parents, like, put a roof over your head, make sure you had enough to eat, all that kind of stuff. But the affection and stuff wasn't really there because they didn't get it. I know she loves me. Like, I know without a doubt that she does. I just think that typically in some countries, Britain being one of them, you're supposed to know that you're loved by your parents. They don't have to say it. And I think that there's a real problem with that.
Totally. It's powerful that you bring that up, because today is actually Dr. Jane Goodall's 90th birthday.
Wow.
Still kicking. What a powerful woman. And she put something out that of her, like, 9 lessons to live to 90. And I don't remember what all of them are, but number 1 was work hard. And number 9 was, if you feel like you can't do something, help somebody. And there are 2 nuggets too that I think are worthy of Dr. Jane Goodall and 90 beautiful years. And you mentioned that you have grandchildren, and you mentioned the dynamic of your current family and the family that, you know, you grew up in. I want to ask, what does it mean to you to be a grandpa now? And what is not your relationship with being a grandpa, but more, what do you wish to instill on this next generation, 2 generations from you?
Yeah, I guess my mentor in developmental psychology, because I think a lot of mental illness starts in childhood, said all anxiety is separation anxiety. And I add on to that, and it's mostly separation from yourself, right? I think that's the root of anxiety, is this underlying inner critic, this separation separation from self that manifests in your thought patterns about yourself. And if they are critical, if they are negative, that's what you're going to admit to the world, right? Because that's what you're familiar with. And the human brain is lazy. It will go back to whatever was programmed into it unless you actively change it. So mm-hmm. I think what happens is that we become more separate from ourselves. And what I would teach my grandkids, and I say that they call me Paco, and no one knows where Paco comes from. And it's actually the name of my company, Paco Connections Incorporated, because it's, and I always say to them, like every time I see them, I look them right in the eyes and I go, Paco loves you and Paco's here for you. And they nod their head like, okay, they know. And I said that to them many, many times on this vacation. Paco loves you and Paco's here for you. So it's really teaching them that they can trust love. It's safe to be connected to people and it's safe to be connected to themselves. And I think both of them are kind of a little on the shy side for sure. I have a friend, Nima, who has a son, Dominic, and Dominic is just a ball of fire. Like you're in an elevator with him and with a bunch of adults, he'll look up and he'll go, how's your day going? You know, now my grandkids are nothing like that. They're very shy. They're very introverted. And what was great about this holiday was there were 16 of us and both of them loved to swim. So they would be a little shy at first, but they would go swimming with everybody in the group. Right. And that would bond them together. So they had a tremendous amount of connection through this trip as well. So what I would sort of try in my best to hand down to them is it's safe to love. Like it's safe to be connected, which is something that I didn't get.
Yeah. And now you're giving it to them on a platter, two hands, two eyeballs every time they meet Paco.
Right.
That is so sweet. So sweet. Though I don't want to overlook that you said separation anxiety, the impact of separation anxiety, mostly with ourselves. And I often share that I have an amazing Bernedoodle and his name's Bernie. And one of the best qualities of Bernedoodles is separation anxiety. Because Bernedoodles just want to be with you. They right. just want to be love. And I think, and maybe I'm a crazy dog parent, I just can't help but think that he is here to be a teacher that says, I'm here to be loved and to remind you that you need to love me. And he's up for anything. He will not miss a beat. But don't you dare leave Bernie at home. Don't you dare leave Bernie in a corner.
Yeah.
And I share that as a bit of a deflection to the question about self, yet it's a question for you, my friend, of what is your daily practice to return to self, or what is your daily practice or ritual or commitment around self and self before you fill your cup with 16 others and the rest of us, 80,000 book readers?
Yeah. Well, I also have dogs too. I don't know if you can see there.
You sure so can.
There's Buddha, who's in the back, who's almost 15. Riley, who's the black one, who's 7. And Ellie, who's a maniac, who's 3. And they're all Labradoodles,
amazing.
But they all look very different. So,
yes. They're very doodles, lab in appearance.
Doodles, yeah. Yeah. Doodles are very interesting dogs for sure. Because Buddha, when I got him almost 15 years ago, he was there with his sister. There was 5 in his litter. 3 were black. 2 were goldens like him. And his sister was a maniac, just running around. And he was in the back corner like, what's up, dude? Like, he's not moving. He's just like, so I pick him up and he just sort of melts into my arm. So we thought, Cynthia and I, my wife and I thought, well, Labradoodles are a pretty chill breed. So we've got 2 new ones. And those 2 are both maniacs. Separation anxiety, all this stuff. So I connect with them every day. So we go for a walk in the morning, we go for a walk in the evening, that kind of thing. And it's just, you know, they're all going different ways all the time. Cynthia's a lot better at training them than I am, but we go out for a walk and, you know, there is something about looking up, I think, when you're walking, because I think when you're feeling down or depressed or whatever, we tend to look down. And one of the things that has been reported is if you move your eyes from side to side, this way and this way, it lowers the activity in the amygdala. And the amygdala is a mediator of just about every fear reaction in human beings. So connecting with myself, I wake up every morning. I have this meditation that I make for myself. I make my own hypno meditations. I have this little studio upstairs, otherwise known as my wife's walk-in closet. And I create these meditations for myself. And a lot of them are, you know, connecting with the younger version of you, taking some time, putting your hand over that alarm sensation in my solar plexus, which I believe is a younger version of me, and just breathing into it. And also there's these Tibetan bowl songs that I have on Spotify. So I will breathe to that for about 10 minutes. So I do like a 20 minute meditation that I make myself. And then I do the Tibetan bowls breathing. And then I do about 15, 20 minutes of yoga. Then I have my cornflakes and then I start my day.
So you're connected to self. You are connected to breath. You're connected to cornflakes. The pups go for a walk and off you go.
Yeah. And then I'll just decide. Amazing. I have a whiteboard that sort of writes down everything that I need to do in the next couple of weeks. And then I don't erase them once I've done them. I put a line through them so that I can actually look at what I've done, because I have a tendency to do. And then at the end of the day, I think, well, what did I do today? And I don't even remember. And I don't appreciate myself enough. But when I draw lines through what I've created, I can actually see what I've done for the day. And that's something I recommend to everybody. Like, get a whiteboard. You know, write down even the most trivial thing, even like, you know, do poop patrol in the backyard, do, you know, mow the lawn, get checks from the bank, like just cross them out. And then at the end of the day, you see what you've done. And it actually makes a huge difference for me.
I love it. I know our clock is ticking and I should ask you the last question, yet I'm very inspired to ask you one more question. Is that okay?
That's fine.
The question I want to know is, there is a lot of talk of the looking down. There's a lot of talk of the current state of our world in as it relates to our mental health. And, you know, listening to you speak, I just wish we could perhaps renovate that it's not mental health that lives in our brain, or perhaps it is. And yet when it lives in our body, then it just becomes our health. And how can we look at this through a different lens, or actually just treat it, be in a different conversation? Step one, read book one. Step two, read the next book. Yes. And I want to know your relationship with joy, Dr. Russ. What is your relationship with joy? How do you dance with it? And I hear your whiteboard. I'm like, it's step one of appreciating yourself. Tell me more.
Yeah, it's tenuous, because when I was younger, joy was always, and this is true with a lot of my anxious peeps as well, especially if you grew up with a family where there's addiction or alcoholism or whatever. I didn't grow up with alcoholism, but my dad was often on different medications and stuff. But when things go along fine for a while and then they explode, this is a very alcoholic pattern. So this is, and then there's a period of, you know, relative quiet, and the alcoholic or whatever is apologetic and I'm sorry, it'll never happen again. And then there's this sort of period of quiet, and then it builds up again, then explodes again. So there is this sense in a lot of people that with anxiety, depression, OCD, eating disorders, all this kind of stuff, that their childhood was like that. It was okay for a while, and then all of a sudden it would explode. So what unconsciously we get conditioned to think is, don't get too comfortable and don't be too happy, because this is all going to come to an end, which was our experience, right? As a child, because as kids, we're in the moment. Right. So when things blow up, it's a huge, huge deal. We don't get into this thing as kids like, oh, this has happened like 20 times before. It's going to get better again. It's huge at that point, and it imprints in our brains. So it makes us not trust joy, not trust safety. And when you don't trust safety, it's very hard to heal from anything, physical, emotional, whatever. So it's learning how to trust safety in small increments. And this is where a lot of like living in the moment comes from and that kind of thing. But it really is about connecting with that younger version of you. It really is. Like, we can do all sorts of CBT, all sorts of cognitive learning, this kind of thing. But until we really go back and connect with that younger version of ourselves, and we don't actually have to go into the story of it, but we do have to find the feeling of it in our body, and allow that feeling to be there and embrace that feeling, even though it's painful. And typically what most people do is when they feel that alarm feeling in their body, they go right up into their heads and start overthinking, because as a child, that was the only option. But as an adult, you actually have the option of staying with the pain and metabolizing it. And Bessel van der Kolk talks about that in The Body Keeps the Scores. We're not teaching people how to get rid of their anxiety. We're teaching you how to acclimatize the feeling so that you don't have to compulsively and relentlessly add these horrible thoughts to what is an uncomfortable feeling. Because if you always go into your head whenever you feel this alarm in your body never gets metabolized. It never changes because you always detour into your head. And the little analogy that I draw is, say you want to learn how to ride a motorcycle and you have a motorcycle in your front yard or your front driveway and you read 500 books on how to ride the motorcycle. Now, until you actually get on that motorcycle and maybe fall off a couple of times, you're never going to learn how to ride it. And it's the same thing with the alarm. Until we go into that alarm and maybe fall off a couple of times. And I'm not minimizing it because it's given me pretty huge for people. But unless we deal with the root cause, which is this alarm that's stuck in our body, the anxious thoughts of our mind aren't going
to
stop.
All right. So let's get to the pain so we can experience joy. And let's not overlook the reality that the pain in our body has kept us from metabolizing joy. I think tremendous joy is possible. And this is really critical work because, as you know, we know life is short.
Yeah. And in a philosophical sense, Steph, joy is pain.
Yeah. It's intense, I was waiting for it.
Emotion. If you can learn how to stay with and be with intense emotion, that's joy. It's the same thing. And a lot of the ancient, you know, Ayurvedic sages would say that intense emotion doesn't really matter if it's painful emotion or joyful emotion. It's kind of all the same. And it's only your subjective interpretation of it that makes it bad.
It's not good. It's not bad. Yeah. I'm here for that. I'm here for that. Well, we have to wrap. And the last question, as promised, it's not good. It's not bad. It can be painful. But I want to know what's making your heart beat faster.
The second edition of my book. So I had a chance. The first edition I kind of wrote out of my head. And it was just, I had the idea because I read Eat, Pray, Love. And I love the whole idea of writing 108 short chapters. Now that was a kind of a fiction book, but this is a nonfiction book and it's basically 108 chapters. Like I think chapter 62 is when it's not safe to feel safe. Some of the chapters are a page long, some of them are 8 pages long. So it's one of those things that I had a chance to go back and revisit after doing, you know, 200 plus podcasts and reevaluating my theory and making everything a lot sharper and more fun and adding some more humor. Even though most people say the book is kind of funny to start with, I had a chance to add some of my humor in there too. So this work, the second edition that's coming out September the 17th, is the best work I've ever done. And it just makes my heart sing to be able to go back and take something that was already good and just make it amazing.
I love it. What a gift. What a gift to realize that after all of these things, which, I mean, your list of who you are and the labels is too long to list, you can still find something so magical to make your heart sing. There's more. From medical school in 87 to September 17th, 2024, your second book being published globally with two international publishers, it brings me joy. And I will ensure there are tons of links below. I am grateful for every minute. I'm grateful to be 200 plus on the podcast list. And you're a really fascinating human. So thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks, Stephanie. I'll accept that. I will Beautiful. Take that in with love and joy. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, hey, before you go, you know, listening to podcasts on this thing called the internet, it's a wild ride. And what would be so helpful on our wild journey is if you would be so kind to jump on and give us a review. 4, maybe even 5 stars. It really helps. Thanks for joining us.